I have met them. I don't claim to know them well.
Yeah.
Because they were living on the other side of town from me. Actually, where I used to live in Bloomington was really close to where they live.
Mm.
But when we came back from Germany, we went from the west part of town to the east part of town. And that's an interesting divide here in Bloomington.
Oh, I thought you were going to say in Germany.
Well, no, because he did end up in Germany.
He did, yeah. He's singing over there. But you know, the west side versus the east side is also an interesting divide in Germany, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Where is he in Germany? I can't remember.
That I'm not sure. Yeah, not sure where they are. But my wife and I did a lot of musical theater when we were kids, and was with those two. They were always in the shows with us.
Okay.
Well, Arl, I want to get to know you. I want to know about yourself, including, but not limited to, what got you into bagpipes? Why bagpipes? What keeps you interested? What kinds of bagpipes, too? Because I've seen you playing other bagpipes. And, I mean, you're kind of a knowledge source. If I'm not mistaken, tell me if I'm mistaken, but if I'm not mistaken, I think the first time that you and I ever interacted on the internet was you helped me to understand, in the Dronehenge group, you helped me to understand that what I had been referring to as a flea hole on my experimental Highland bagpipe chanter was actually a register hole.
Yeah. Okay, I'd forgotten about that, but yeah. I remember that now.
Yeah, so you know about bagpipe stuff. So yeah, how'd that all get started? When did little Arl first encounter bagpipes, and what was that like?
Well, I'd always liked the sound of them growing up. I didn't get my first bagpipe until 1999.
Mm.
When I picked up, somebody managed to pick up a Kaba Gaida for me from Bulgaria.
That's where it started, huh? Not Highland bagpipes in a town band or anything like that.
No. And actually, I've never played Highland pipes. And
look at that.
Don't really. Oddly enough, although I like the sound of them, I don't have any desire to play them.
Yeah, well, that's fun because, I mean, maybe it's just because of where I'm coming from. It seems like the most common explanation for bagpipe interest, at least in the United States, right? Is that, of course, there are other kinds and you can get to them, but most people kind of start there. That's usually seems like that's the trajectory.
Yeah. Well, and there's an interesting thing that I see from bagpipe players over the years is a lot of them start out there.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not that they don't like Highland pipes, but they find the whole culture around it with you play this the way the pipe major says you play it. And
yeah,
variation is not allowed. They find it stifling and they move over to other pipes because they can do what they want. And they just find it so much more musically liberating.
Yes. Yeah.
But then I meet people who, I'll use a religious analogy. Maybe they're fundamentalists and that they like that the pipe major gives them the absolute truth and they don't have to question it. And
mm-hmm.
if they do that, they know that their bagpipe salvation is achieved.
Arl, I have a sheet of notes that I've been keeping for years. Cause there's this intellectual who studies, the intersection of music and language and has this idea that like the two developed together. But I saw him on a YouTube channel called Religion for Breakfast years ago. And they were talking about how music and religion and language all interact. And that sparked the idea. This sheet of notes is so that I can approach him someday to let me pitch him my idea that competitive Highland bagpipes is a religion. There are holy vestitures and saints there's orthodoxy and there's orthopraxy and all these things.
Yeah, I don't think that's much of a stretch to argue.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so, and
do you know people go the other way? Like, how many people like start playing Illan pipes and are like, you know what? Actually, I want to do the Highland piping thing and competitively, specifically.
I don't know that I've met anybody who's done that. I do know there are, so I overlap a bit with Northumbrian piping.
Mm.
And I do know that there are some people who start out with Northumbrian pipes and will adopt Highland piping because it puts them in the opportunity of some commercial. Or professional gigs.
But
that's what people want.
Yeah, totally. I mean, that's my Highland pipes have paid for all my other bagpipes. Like the other ones have never brought money to me. They only cost money.
Yeah. And I think about it, you know, because I don't play Highland pipes, I don't ever get, I've had one paid job once and it was at a funeral for a friend and, they paid me $150 or something for a few minutes of Northumbrian pipe music. And I didn't want to be paid. And I told the friend's widow, I said, you know, I can't take your money. And she said, no, it's a package I pay to the funeral home. And if they don't pay you, they keep the money. So please take it. But that's the only paid bagpipe gig I've ever had.
It's funny how it goes. I mean, like I've tried, you know, like I've pitched it as an idea to potential customers when they're like, well, you know, for my wedding or for this birthday surprise or whatever, you know, here's what we want to do. And I've been like, you know, we'll be indoors and you want me to be playing for like, how about these pipes? You know, like here's an option. And they always want the Highland pipes.
They want their ears to bleed by the end.
Yeah,
of the
apparently. but it started with a gaita then. And what specific kind that you, what you said was not Galician. And that's the only kind I'm really familiar with.
So Kaba Gaida, G-A-I-D-A, so the Bulgarian, the big, low Bulgarian pipes.
Oh, how did that, like, who had a connection to get you a set of those? Like, how did that happen?
So, of the pipes, actually, I talked about this in a review I did of an album, but it was my first real exposure to non-Highland pipes was listening to kind of a bootlegged recording of pipes from Macedonia, which are basically identical. And then I had a friend in university who was from Bulgaria, and she was going home over Christmas. And she said, and I said, hey, can you find these? So she found them, and they weren't expensive. She brought back this plastic-wrapped package that smelled of goat.
Yeah,
because
so you know it's real.
Not even a tanned leather bag. It's cured with salt.
Wow.
And so it smelled like a dead goat. And my wife's like, you can't keep that inside. And so I played that for a while. And then they developed some problems and became unplayable.
Mm-hmm.
I still have them. I need to try and get them going again. Need a new bag.
So I've seen these floating around. I've seen these on the internet, looking at pictures now. This is the usually a pretty big bag that you hug, chanters around the other side, drones hanging toward the ground. What, one drone?
Yeah, single drone. Yeah, it's typically, some players will put it up over the shoulder, but typically it hangs down.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this big white bag, which may have, patchy spots of hair on it, depending on whether they turned it inside or outside. But typically white, with a the chanter stock is a piece of cow horn, and then the chanter will be about maybe 11 inches long, with a kind of a hook on not a hook but a bend kink on the end.
Yeah.
And if you were going to pick three countries that I would say really have well developed mass bagpiping traditions, obviously Scotland, everybody knows that from the mass ensembles, but I think the biggest, if I remember correctly, the biggest single group of bagpipers ever assembled was actually in Bulgaria playing Bulgarian bagpipes, because they're hugely popular there. Although starting in the kind of the late Soviet era, they started playing them often without drones and treating them as what they called skin saxophones.
Skin saxophones, huh?
Yeah, and so they play all this stuff, but without the drones, so they could blend with other instruments.
You know, it speaks to my, what is this? Is this an instance of parochialism that, like, most of my awareness of Bulgarian bagpiping only is in my head at all thanks to Breja Campbell, and so it's only via Scottish small piping that I even have a reference point for that music.
Yeah. Well, if you ever get a chance, this guy is, he is a bagpiper, but his background comes out of the Bulgarian and Macedonian tradition. But Lindsay Pollock, this Aussie guy who will make instruments out of anything and everything.
Oh, yeah.
So he'll, he plays things like a baseball bat that he's a hollow, baseball bat that he's put a mouthpiece on and he uses, or he made a, what he called Mr. Curly. It was a bass clarinet made out of a coiled sprinkler pipe.
Oh, I'm looking at his stuff right now. This is cool.
But when he plays Bulgarian or Macedonian piping, you would think he grew up in that tradition. He's that good. And he cut an album. He brought Macedonian musicians to Australia in the 70s, back when that was no mean feat, and played with him. And I've listened to the recording. You would think that he was just part of a crack Macedonian band.
That's pretty cool. Oh, I see the, looks like he just called the album Macedonian Folk Music.
Yeah, I don't know that I've actually listened to that one. It was another one I listened to that was it was great. I was asked to review it, and I'm like, this sounds like somebody pulled an old tape out of a glove box, and it was sort of field recordings made back in the 70s that had finally been issued.
So you're in college, you hear this bootleg tape of Bulgarian bagpipes, you have a Bulgarian friend, you say, hey, can you help me get some of those? You get them, you have to keep them outside for a while. Play them till they can't be played anymore. Where does it go from there?
Well, the next thing I picked up was, I think in 1999, I got a set of Hungarian bagpipes, because I'd lived in Hungary, knew the sound of them. They're very different from Bulgarian bagpipes. And so I picked up this set of Hungarian bagpipes. And I was just incredibly frustrated. They never worked the reeds at the same time. And it turns out, I'd gotten them from this store in Budapest. And it turns out they were from this, I put maker in air quotes. He's kind of notorious for instruments of bagpipes and hurdy-gurdies of dubious quality.
I see, yeah.
And so I'd kind of learned some things from that. And then I'd moved to Bloomington in 2001. And after I'd been here a few years, there was a Hungarian band visiting, and I ended up with the job of taking them around and showing them around. And the bagpiper for that group let me try his pipes, and he gave me some instruction, and he made fun of my little bagpipe. One of the names for bagpipes in Hungarian is dog pipes, because traditionally they were made with a dog skin bag.
Oh.
And he looked at mine and he called it the cat pipes, because it was little and made a horrible sound.
Oh, is that why? I feel like it's not uncommon with Hungarian bagpipes that the chanter stock, the part that the chanter comes down out of, it's got like this like decorative forked wood thing above it. Have you seen that before?
Yeah.
It might be a sampling error that I've only seen those, and that's not that common.
It's considered actually goat horns there, even if the bag's made
from dogs. Yeah. See, I was thinking to myself, is that supposed to be a dog's head? You know, like maybe those are supposed to be dog ears. I see. Goat horns, though. That makes sense, too.
Yeah, it's a goat's head, although you get some of these kind of fringe movement people in Hungary who will claim that it's really an ancient sacrificial bull, and it shows that they were related to the Sumerians and this kind of
everybody wants to be related to the Sumerians, right? I mean, everybody.
But it's a goat's head. Gotcha. And you'll find some even with ram's heads with curled horns and things. But so, yeah, I had that horrible pipe. And then in 2005, I went back to Hungary to do research for what became my dissertation. And while I was there, I'd actually picked up hurdy-gurdy. I had a pretty decent hurdy-gurdy from a Hungarian maker. And I said, I really want some bagpipes. And he says, well, okay, talk to my friend Botolin Tbesha. and or Boti as he gets called. And so Boti made me a set of pipes, which I'm still using. Fantastic pipes. I won't say they're bare bones. He does absolutely beautiful metal work inlay on the drones. But he didn't, they weren't particularly ornate compared to some he did, but they're just very rock solid, steady pipes. I've played them extensively since 2005. I've never had to replace the bag, never had to season the bag. He figured out some tanning process.
Wow, really?
Blistering. Where seasoning, I asked him about seasoning. He says, no, don't ever do anything. You'll ruin the bag if you do.
Well, I want to know his secrets. My goodness. I could save myself a lot of trouble if I had an eternally seasoned bag.
Yeah, well, part of it is that they're intact skin bags, so there's no seams to wear out.
Oh, gotcha. Yeah, I mean, that makes sense. A lot of the seasoning does get down in the seam to keep that tight.
Yeah, but he was right. There's some spots I can see at some point I'm going to have to patch on the bag, because, you know, eventually you do wear out a hole, but not yet. And it's interesting when you're using an intact leather bag like that, that in the winter it gets crispy crunchy as the humidity goes down. And then out here in Indiana, where in the middle of the summer, you can experience firsthand what a lobster feels like the moment before it dies. The bag gets super soft and supple as it absorbs humidity. So that was my first real bagpipe. And subsequently, I acquired another one from him that is, so the normal pitch of Hungarian pipes is somewhere around A or B flat. I subsequently acquired another one from him that I absolutely love the sound of, that's in F, and has this absolutely massive bag, and its bellows blown. But the thing is so freaking big that I just don't play it a lot, because, you know, it's got this drone. When it's over my shoulder, I, you know, whack somebody halfway across the room if I turn.
Yeah. But that is also a Hungarian, in like the same fingering system and stuff like that.
Yeah. So what sets the Hungarian, traditional Hungarian pipes apart? Yeah, they're part of a group that's called contra chanter pipes, that is technically a double chanter.
Oh, okay.
Or more. Mm-hmm. But the base form is you have one bore that plays from either the tonic to the octave or from the second to the octave. Both variations exist. And then the other pipe plays the octave or drops down to the dominant below. So you're playing something, and then you're using your little finger on the lower hand to go pop, 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 pop for rhythmic accompaniment or a sort of a self-harmonization. So that's the standard one. And then what sets the Hungarian ones apart from neighboring variations like Slovak pipes is the addition of the flea hole that allows you to play them chromatically.
Gotcha.
Although a lot of the older players didn't actually play them chromatically, they use it as basically a tremolo hole.
That makes
hit
sense.
A note and you'll flutter your finger and you get this you know, kind of effect. The bigger pipe I have represents a Western Hungarian tradition that actually provides a third bore in the chanter that is a stopped pipe just for the octave. And that doesn't sound like a big difference, but as I've gotten used to it, I've realized it actually ends up making a big difference in playing if the octave sounds separately from everything else, because you have some more self-harmonizing possibilities and the playing technique actually ends up a bit different.
Do those second and third bores, are they playing constantly or is there, I see. So, though movable, what note is going to be played? It's kind of droney then.
Yeah, I think of it as a variable drone.
Yeah.
Then there's just because you ask if they're always playing. Then you get in Croatia a variation which has four pipes in the chanter. That's the most I know of, other than one maker who's done some interesting experimental things. But what you have is one the main boar plays from the second to the sixth. There is no seventh on the pipes.
Well, who needs it anyway, huh?
Yeah. And it's a debate
between minor, the debate between minor and major seventh isn't a problem when you don't have a seventh at all, right? Just stop over it.
You don't use it. But for that, then that pipe stops. So if all your fingers are down, it doesn't make a sound. You have a stop thumb pipe for the octave. And then the contra, that variable drone, is actually split between two stop pipes that are controlled by two fingers rather than one. And if both fingers are down, this chanter doesn't make any sound. But so you could play something on it like the fifth below the tonic, the third, and the octave. So you can get a full major triad playing on these, inverted triad.
That's
with an
cool.
octave playing on these chanters.
Yeah, that's big sound. That's awesome.
Yeah. But then beyond that, the other pipes I play is Swedish pipes.
Okay.
Which I ended up getting in a trade. I'd gotten an Italian Piva that I actually ended up not liking and traded it for a Swedish pipe just straight across the board for a guy who really wanted the Piva. And then I played got some Northumbrian pipes from a friend, I want to say in 2000. And he wanted to sell them, and he said, yeah, go ahead, try them out, decide if you want them. And he gave them to me, and they were unplayable. I said, are these, do you know, something wrong with you? He says, no, that's the way they're supposed to be. I'm like, no, they're not. So I consulted with someone, and I think he got rid of them because they had never been playable, but I was able to get them over the course of about 3 weeks back into prime playing shape. You know, it was readjustment, cleaning the chanter, replacing pads on the keys, and working to get the drone reeds working. And now I play them regularly and they sound great. And so, you know, he gave me a pretty good deal on them because he just wanted to offload them.
Yeah. It's convenient when that happens. Actually, speaking of Hungary, I had a friend here locally who was moving to Hungary, and he said, you know, I've got these bagpipes. I don't want to take them with me. And I got a second set of bagpipes from him for, I can't remember, like it was like $200 or something. You know, not trying to take advantage or anything, just like, well, I mean, I could take them, you know, it's nice to have a friend who just wants to offload bagpipes, isn't it?
Yeah, I had somebody like that several years back, and I could kick myself because I just didn't have much money right then. And he'd offered to sell me a set of Galician pipes for $150 or something, and didn't have it right then.
Yeah.
And then he ended up passing them on to somebody else later for over $1,000. I also play Galician pipes, not terribly well, but I was in Spain for work, and my boss knew I was interested and picked up a set of Galician pipes.
That's a good boss.
And then the other pipes I've got is from Nicholas Conradson in Lincolnshire, a little double chantered, partially parallel pipe. He calls it a medieval pipe.
Yeah.
And I've got to say, it's probably the funnest pipe I have to play.
Is it the second chanter has like the bottom three or four notes, or is it all the way up and down? Like you lay your fingers over the top of both holes kind of thing?
So what it's got is one of the chanters is tonic through the fourth. The other one sounds the tonic if you've got all your fingers down, but then it picks up at the fourth and goes through the seventh with no octave, oddly enough.
Oh, interesting.
Although I figured out if with bag pressure, you can quite easily get a reliable octave. Give it an extra
squeeze it up. So with the travel and everything, Arl, like what was your dissertation? Like, what was it you were studying? I gather it was not bagpipes specifically. Is that just a convenient thing that was happening on the side, or was it bagpipes specifically?
So I was in the folklore studies program at Indiana University.
Oh, cool.
And I probably should have done ethnomusicology, but I don't play well by ear. And I thought, well, I don't really have some of the skills I should have to be in ethnomusicology. So what I ended up doing was actually a dissertation on the revival in Hungary of bagpipes and hurdy-gurdies.
Oh.
But focusing on the physical aspects of the instrument.
Mm.
So, I mean, some on the music, but it was more on like, what were the goals of the people who were reviving them? How did they conceive of the instruments? What was the cultural meaning?
Mm.
The religious meaning, I guess, going back to the theme earlier about fundamentalism and whatnot, is at least bagpipes in Hungary were really strongly associated with these anti-Soviet Catholic movements in the country.
Interesting. I had no idea.
Yeah, so the folk movement in Hungary, interestingly, it's like in the U.S. and elsewhere, it was oppositional, but oppositional there meant you were pretty Euro-conservative. I mean, these are guys who would fit in the MAGA movement in the U.S. Quite nicely, whereas all the folkies in the U.S. are like, you know, well, I'm super leftist.
Yeah, pretty
my credentials.
Right, Pete, following in the footsteps of Pete Seeger kind of thing, right? Yeah. Wow, that's interesting. So do you feel like, is it a coincidence then? Like, is it the fact that hurdy-gurdies figured into that field that had you interested in hurdy-gurdy, or is it the drone sound? Are you drawn to drones in general?
Oh, absolutely.
Mm.
You know, the first time I heard hurdy-gurdy was actually in Hungary. I heard recording by the band Teka, T-E-K-A, and I like the sound of the hurdy-gurdy. And so again, I picked up a hurdy-gurdy at some point. It was a piece of junk, actually by the same maker who made the piece of junk bagpipe.
Oh, really? You got the full experience, huh?
Oh, yeah. But then I met a decent maker who made me the one I still play and use. Mm. It's a workhorse of an instrument.
I don't know if you'll have a take on this, Arl, but it seems to me like there's a surprising overlap amongst bagpipers of people who, if you play bagpipes, there's a decent chance that you also either play or are very interested in accordion, banjo, and hurdy-gurdy.
That sounds like a setup for a joke here.
It does, doesn't it? Like, it really does. But it seems like that tends to happen. Like, a lot of bagpipers, I think, are at least hurdy-gurdy curious, if not dabbling.
Yeah, definitely. And a lot of the drone-oriented gatherings will have courses in both of them and play together. So, yeah, although hurdy-gurdy, it's an interesting one, has gone. When I first started playing, you know, it was hard to find information, and we were a bunch of, you know, kind of weirdos out doing it. And for various reasons, I'd say the number of hurdy-gurdy players since I started has probably gone up tenfold.
Mm.
And
there are some hurdy-gurdy players on YouTube that are like really cool, you know, like it's a really cool thing.
Well, I think the funnest one is, and I've seen him perform live twice, is Willem Desk, who's a French guy, and D-E-S-Q is how he spells it. And he got known for doing basically some covers of like AC/DC on his hurdy-gurdy.
Mm.
And some of his things are really homage to heavy metal, but then he's out doing kind of free jazz and all kinds of stuff. He's pretty incredible.
Yeah. So, like, what are you doing, like, the most of right now? Like, what's got your interest most sucked into it right now? Is it hurdy-gurdy every day? Is it hopping between bagpipes? Or also, like, what else is in the group? What other instruments have you been picking up along the way?
So, I would say the main things I'm playing are hurdy-gurdy and different bagpipes, and they kind of go in runs for a while. So my hurdy-gurdy is sitting neglected.
Mm.
Although I have to get it out because I'm going to be using it in some a Revolutionary War reenactment work.
Oh, really? That's fun. Oh, yeah. I've seen you do some in costume for a few things like that. Is that something that comes up pretty often for you?
I think this year I'm going to have three different gigs for that. And, you know, you show up, you get paid basically enough that I can, cover my costs. It's not,
yeah,
but it's fun. I then have blown whatever I would have made on making costume, but that's another thing. But yeah, so I'll do that. And I take bagpipes along for the ride, particularly Northumbrian pipes, just for the era, more or less. So I'll be doing that. I play a lot of other things, mostly kind of simple winds. So Irish whistle, the Hungarian wooden equivalents to that. I have a harmonium that I use, Jew's harp, just a bunch of odds and ends. But really the focus has been hurdy-gurdy and bagpipes. And then I play piano and organ as well. But musically, the thing I've actually gotten into most lately is starting in late 2020, there was a call out I happened to see for a Slavic choir.
Oh.
And I joined that, and I just absolutely love it. We're singing mostly Ukrainian repertoire, all in tight three-part harmony. And for me, it's probably been the most interesting musical thing, in that I've really had to learn to listen in a way that I never did before. Because when you sing this, you're not giving printed music. It's listen to this part, learn to sing it, and now make it fit. With everybody around you, and if you have to change it to make it fit, you better be listening enough to know how to change it.
So you have to be really flexible for where you start and keep those intervals no matter where you started, huh?
Yeah, and we may change pitch from day to day.
Yeah.
So
playing fast and loose, huh?
I'd recommend anybody who wants to learn really to do stuff by ear, go do that. And then, of course, playing bagpipes, I'm spoiled on most instruments, because now that you play bagpipe, pretty quickly you learn how to hear those intervals to a degree of precision that, if you just play piano, that's a fifth.
Yeah.
Bagpipes, you're like, no, that fifth on your piano, that's not a fifth. It's off. You're off by 12 cents or whatever it is.
Sure. So do you feel like, would you ever present yourself as a person in possession of the legendary perfect pitch, or do you feel more like you just have decent tonal memory?
Yeah, decent tonal memory. There's a few pitches I can, recognize pretty well, because because as a singer, I know, how they feel internally. It's hard to explain that I think you were in musical theater, you would get it, that... You know how they feel, and from that, then you know what pitch it is.
Yeah. So, you mentioned some of the costuming. I'm not sure exactly when this episode will have gone out, but I know that, right now while we're talking, fairly recently, you posted some really awesome stitching embroidery work that you did on a...
Oh, on the bagpipe cover?
Yeah. I'm not sure which type of pipe. I'm guessing it must have been the type of pipes that take bellows. Was it that F?
Yeah, it was Northumbrian pipes.
Oh, gotcha. That was some really cool work, though. When did this stuff become? And I think I've seen a jacket that you made before as well in the past. Yeah,
probably a waistcoat. But
yeah. So where did that come into it? The skilled stitchery. Where did that come into your life?
So that actually came out of the reenactment work where they brought me in as a musician. So I showed up for the first thing I did, and it was run by... a facility in the National Park Service, and they said, you can come look through our library of clothes, basically. And so I found some breeches and stuff, and I didn't know anything. And I show up and very quickly realized that the waistcoat they gave me was wrong era. It was 1750s. Did things really change? They changed just as fast as they do today. So imagine you're showing up for something commemorating the 80s, and you show up with something from 2000, you're going to stick out like a sore thumb.
Yeah.
So I had the wrong waistcoat. I had these breeches that were they were super baggy. They didn't fit at all. And this one fellow gently pointed out to me everything that was wrong with what I was wearing.
At least he was gentle about it.
Yeah, I actually really liked the guy. And it could have been super discouraging, but
yeah.
I ended up buying some fabric saying, okay, I'm going to if I'm going to do this, I might as well learn to do it myself.
Yeah. Yeah.
Cause that's the only way I'm going to get anything that fits. So I ended up buying some breeches that same time so that I would have some that fit a little bit better. But I ended up making and now have made a couple sets of breeches, waistcoats. I'm going to be making a jacket before May. And that original set of breeches that I bought because the loaned pair were so absolutely horrible, I'm now recutting them and actually making them fit properly. So I've really gotten into that, but it came out of the musical side of things.
I see. That makes sense, though. So has your interest in, like, historical accuracy and making your own things, has that also manifested in instruments? Like, have you disassembled your hurdy-gurdy and put it back together and thought about, I mean, you know, with your dissertation especially, like, thought about, like, well, in such and such a decade, they would have had this string, but in the other decades, they might not have had that at all, or anything, any of that kind of stuff coming up for you?
I'm just laughing because if you ask my wife, she will say a musical instrument isn't mine until I've completely disassembled and rebuilt it.
I see, yeah.
everything I get gets torn apart sooner or later.
Mm-hmm.
I don't tend to get too hung up on historical accuracy in the instruments because, you know, I'm not going to say, oh, I'd never use a metal string on that. It has to be gut. Uh-huh. Like, yeah, does it sound good? But I will probably have some sense at the same time of what would and wouldn't have been done because I just find it interesting.
Yeah.
And then for making instruments, I don't have access to all the tools right now. It's something I really want to get into, but 3D printing.
Mm-hmm.
Has been really fascinating for me. So I've made experimental bagpipe designs that I can 3D print and try stuff out. And I'm in the process. I've got to solve some problems with keys, but I was working on a drop-in plug-in replacement for a Hungarian chanter that could be played. If you just play it like Hungarian chanter, it would sound like one, but it would have keys and other stuff to be, you know, fully chromatic over a range of an octave and a half with polyphonic capabilities. And the prototype actually sounds really good, even 3D printed, but I could never get the key work to function quite right. So I need to spend some time with that.
Hmm. Is it like, have you taken over multiple rooms in the house and it's just constantly a collection of partially disassembled instruments throughout, or have you been relegated to a shed in the backyard, or like what is the physical space like for your musical interests?
We're in a small enough house that if I sprawl too much, sooner or later I'm gently reminded that,
yeah,
no, you can't keep the kitchen table occupied for multiple days. So yeah. Stuff then has to be put away and migrate, you know, off to where it belongs. So I'm limited in my ability to sprawl, and I envy, what was his name? Brian Casey. I can't remember which guy who has a bagpipe yurt.
Oh, is he in Australia?
No, I guess it's not Brian Casey. Oh, what was his name? He was a guy out in Oregon, and he has a yurt that's probably 15, 20 feet across, and it's where he keeps his instruments.
That's pretty cool. That's pretty darn cool.
So I guess I need a yurt, but in Indiana in the summer, the yurt would be unbearable.
Yeah, I bet. You get real hot. What about, air quotes here, modern music? Like, is your bandwidth so thoroughly taken up with musics of the past and of the world that there's not a lot of space for like modern popular music, or do you take it all in?
Well, as a consumer for listening to it, yeah, I listen to a lot of contemporary stuff. As a musician, I don't have anything that, you know, piano, other than that, I don't have anything that I could sit down with a rock band and they'd go, oh, okay, I know what that is. Everything I have, they'd be looking at going, what in the world is that?
Yeah.
So it's for me as a musician, it's the older stuff or things, simple things that I can demonstrate to kids. I love going into schools or other things with kids and showing them instruments and letting them get hands-on with them.
Yeah.
I've absolutely loved doing that. And one of my engagements this year is going to be They're commemorating Lafayette's final tour of the U.S. It was 200 years ago. And I'm going to a town where he visited. I'm going to be in a town where he visited, and they're going to be busing in kids all day. Mm. And part of it is I'm going to set up with instruments to show the kids and let them try them.
Oh, very cool. That's brave of you, though. Like, how many of your instruments would be very difficult to replace if they were, you know, dropped or something?
A lot of them. So the ones I'll let, you know, there's some I'll say, okay, kids, you can turn the crank on the hurdy-gurdy, but no, you know.
You can't hold it. Yeah.
But a lot of the ones I have that are, let's say, more robust, I'll be like, okay, yeah, you can try that one.
Yeah.
You want to try my cheapo mountain dulcimer? Great, have at it.
Mm. So give me a desert island scenario, Arl, of all the instruments you currently have in your possession. If you had to have only one of them for the rest of your life, what would you pick?
I would probably say Northumbrian small pipes.
Mm.
But if you were on a desert island, that would probably be the absolute
worst
choice. Because you know,
desert island as a genre. Let's do that.
You're just stuck.
Right. So Northumbria, is it because of like flexibility and range for melody, or what do you feel like it is that makes Northumbrian small pipes stand out to you as the one to pick?
So part of it is flexibility and range. So I have an 11 key set, so it covers
11
not quite
keys.
Two octaves.
I've seen those sets. It's like all keys. I don't even know where you start by putting your fingers down on those. Yeah.
There's some that have had up to 21 keys.
Holy moly.
We joke they look like hedgehogs.
Yeah, they totally, yeah.
But so I'm playing the ones I have are in. Northumbrian pipes are a little weird in that they, for the most part, unless you specifically request ones pitched in modern G, they're pitched in this thing that's called F plus, but notated as G. It's about
F plus
50 cents sharp of F.
Well, that sounds like a bonus. That sounds nice. Why wouldn't you want F plus?
But it's it was a historic G that,
yeah.
Everything moved on, ratcheting pitch up, and they just happily stayed where they were.
Yeah, yeah.
But so I've notated in G, and if you're thinking of it as notated in G, then the range is from D up to a B above the octave.
Hmm.
And
with enough keys, a lot of half steps in between, right?
Yeah. Although Northumbrian pipes are a little odd in that every other bagpipe I've had experience with, if you're going to add a key, it's a minor third.
Hmm.
Without question. It's immediately where you go. You add the minor third. If you're playing Northumbrian pipes, you don't get that until your 17th key.
Wow, really? That is interesting.
And the reason is that historically, when you had keyless bagpipes, and with them, you wanted to play in minor, you would tune your drones up to A.
Hmm.
And then you were playing in Dorian.
Hmm.
Against the drone. And so their attitude is, yeah, you don't need that minor third key because you want to play minor. You just, you know, flip your beads on your drone so that the drones are higher.
Hmm.
And that whole logic of retune the drones rather than force the minor onto the chanter completely inverts the order with which you're going to add keys.
Hmm. Yeah.
It's really kind of strange.
It would be fun. I've often wished for that kind of flexibility with Highland bagpipes. Have more distance that those drones can travel, and so then you can kind of pitch stuff up mm-hmm. mostly, maybe down sometimes, but mostly up, and exactly so that minor stuff would sound, you know, like more like it's like it fits, you know. Like it can be fun to have dissonance, you know, but sometimes it's like, you know, if the air quotes, you know, the Highland bagpipe B is like the main note here and I'm playing like a minorish or modal melody, it'd be cool to have drones that are playing that note, you know?
Yeah, that's one thing I've never quite understood is Scottish pipers, if they're playing complex small pipes, they will gladly change the drone tuner
mm-hmm.
to play along. But if you're on Highland pipes, you do not touch that drone configuration. Doesn't matter what key you're playing in, those drones stay exactly where they are.
Yeah.
And it's part of the sound. which is really kind of odd.
Mm. Yeah, it's an interesting thing. It in some ways, I think, I don't know if I would refer to it as a superpower or that it's ruined me, but in some ways, like playing in that way for enough time, I've sort of made myself, I have a very high tolerance for drones at this point, and by which I mean dissonant drones. And in sometimes it makes it funny when playing with other musicians who aren't used to drones at all. You know, they'll be like, you can't, like the chords just changed, you know, like you can't just keep playing that note, you know?
And I was yeah.
like, yes, I can't do anything else but keep playing that note. And you're I promise it'll be fine. It'll resolve eventually, you know?
I will say if you wanted something a little bit more flexible than Highland Pipes, but similar, the Spanish gaita.
I feel really interested in the gaita. Yeah, I'm hoping to acquire one of those someday.
Because you can actually cross finger that thing, and the intervals are a little weird, but it's essentially chromatic over its range.
Mm-hmm. That's one thing that Jeremy did point out when I was first working on the extended range bagpipe chanter design that I've been working on. He was like, at what point does this become a gaita? You know, like, is the trajectory just, I'm eventually going to have reinvented the, it's just a gaita, you know, like just morph the Highland bagpipe enough that it becomes a gaita.
A gaita with more drones.
Yeah. Yep. Yep.
And louder.
Yeah. And louder. Looking back at gigs that you've done with instruments, Arl, like what's a favorite that stands out to you that if you could do it again, you would, any instrument, whether it's pipes, hurdy-gurdy, anything you got.
So it's been years ago, but I used to get together with some friends. We do Hungarian music, and we did some ensemble where I was playing a 6-hole Hungarian block flute.
Mm.
And one of the guys was playing saz, and we had a singer, and we just had so much fun with that combination.
Yeah, what a cool combo.
Simple, but we just had fun.
Did you find chances to make jokes about the saws having been used to cut the block flute or anything like that?
I said, hey, we probably did.
Yeah, a little bit of that banter in between. I bet it came up. So when you're playing most of the time, like who gets to hear you play? And if I could get you to like just don't even worry about seeming pompous in any way, because I want to know who's your biggest fan, you know, like who is always excited to hear you get an instrument out.
So my dog definitely is not. She hates them. Most of what I do, just because of where I live and time constraints, is it's off just walking around the neighborhood. I do a lot of that. Or I'll play.
Wait, do you strap your hurdy-gurdy on and go for a walk?
It's usually bagpipes for that, although I have worn the hurdy-gurdy and gone around.
You must be a fun character to have in the neighborhood.
Well, like, nobody's tried to run me off yet.
Yeah.
But, I wonder, when I first started doing this, I worried, would people, object? And then I got to know one of the neighbors. And he said, I just love it when I hear your bagpipes because I hear them and I know all is right in the world.
There you go.
That's not always the reaction. One time I was playing I was waiting to pick up my daughter from high school, and I was playing bagpipes in the parking lot, and people would come up and they'd thank me, but I was playing for a while. And finally somebody yells, turn off your stupid bagpipes. Nobody wants to hear them. I just laughed and kept playing because there was, as somebody yelled that, there were some little girls dancing in front of me.
Yeah. Yeah.
So clearly,
at least somebody did. I appreciate that where they went was turn off your bagpipes. That's fun.
So, I like going around in the neighborhood, and then the teaching scenarios, because it's really interesting if you're out, say, busking or something, playing these instruments, that little kids up to about maybe age 11, they will just come up absolutely without any hesitance and be like, oh, what is that? They can see. And then you get the kids who are a little bit older and they're too cool to ask.
Yeah.
And then you get adults who walk by, and I love when they're side-eyeing you. And I'm like, just come over and ask. Somebody playing this clearly Is it going to care? And they clearly want to know, but they're so self-conscious.
Yeah.
That most of them won't come and ask.
So they've got a little kid with them. They can send a little kid to come and ask for them.
The best busking, by the way, I ever did was when my eldest daughter was little, cute little blonde thing, and I made some quarter sheet leaflets about the instrument, and I'd have her hand them out.
Oh, fun.
And for everyone that handed out, we got, on average, we got something like $2 back. Because cute little kid, here, you're you can resist that. Then she got older and self-conscious, and my take in busking went way down. So it wasn't me. It was the cute little blonde kid.
It wasn't you at all, right? Yeah, now you know. And is there a lot of good opportunity for busking in Indiana? Is it like farmers markets and stuff like that? Or are you mostly looking for Renaissance fairs? Or what kind of stuff do you go to?
So, yeah, it was farmers markets, things like that I would go to. I haven't done it in years, but I used to a lot. But now where I'm getting this recreation circuit, so there is a surprising amount of Revolutionary War stuff done in Indiana. And there I'm not really busking, although sometimes people, hand me a few dollars or say, I'm buying you lunch or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But, I get paid a few $100 to do it and have fun.
Mm-hmm. So at least right now, because I'm sure this will change over time, but at least right now, what musicians have you feeling excited? You know, like what musicians are you looking up? What albums are on repeat for you?
So just broadly speaking, not looking specifically at, so bagpipe stuff, I'll say my perennial favorite. And this takes me back into the Scottish realm, even though I don't play it, is Battlefield Band.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
I mean, they're a go-to.
Mm-hmm.
I really like listening to Balkans, bagpipe music. If we're not just looking specifically at bagpipe stuff, I've got to say, Anais Mitchell.
I'm looking up Anais Mitchell right now.
She did, it was behind Hadestown, the musical. But she has done some absolutely fantastic recordings of child ballads, not ballads for kids, but the child is in the name, ballads that were the English ballads.
She's done some fantastic
recordings of those.
Yeah, sorry. I was like, in my head, I was like, first of all, ballads for children? Ballads about children? child ballads, gotcha.
Yeah. So she's fantastic. Another great, great album. Again, not in the bagpipe realm, but if you really want to hear people who understand harmonies, there's a group called The Lost Voice, an album called The Lost Voices of Hagia Sophia, the mosque in Istanbul, where it's Capella Romana is the group. And what they did that I just found amazing is they got permission to go into Hagia Sophia and pop balloons. You say, okay, what's this got to do with music? But it lets them capture the acoustic properties of the space. And then they sang Greek liturgical chant and digitally inserted themselves into the Hagia Sophia to get the exact resonances and reverberations and everything of the Hagia Sophia. And I could listen to that. Well, I do. Sometimes I'll just be like, I need to completely relax, shut out the world. I put that on, and that is the thing that is my go-to for when I want to get into a kind of a meditative state.
You're a language guy, Arl. How many languages? Like, you're listening to Russian liturgical. Do you speak Old Church Russian? like how many of these do you understand?
No. So languages I speak are that I would claim to speak now are English, Hungarian, and German.
Mm-hmm.
I know a bit of Russian, a bit of Ukrainian, not enough to really do much. I used to speak Norwegian quite well, but I haven't used it in so long that it's just gone. And then I've dabbled in various other things, Latin, Welsh, those sorts of things.
I like to imagine that there's something about the friendly rivalry between Sweden and Norway that it's like once you got your Swedish pipes, your Norwegian language abilities had to go because you can't have both.
And maybe, and funnily enough, I have Finnish heritage. And when I'd meet the old Finnish people and I'd say I was speaking Norwegian, they looked at me like I'd grown an extra head. Swedish would have been okay, but Norwegian, what's wrong with you, kid?
Yeah, why? What was it? I think it was my dad who told me that, because he spent some time in Sweden, that all the Swedes were quick to tell him that the Swedish chef on the Muppets is Norwegian. You ever hear that before?
He kind of does have a Norwegian intonation pattern,
yeah,
actually.
Yeah, he definitely speaks Norwegian. Just listen to him. Cool. Well, Arlo, kind of looking for some kind of graceful landing. Any, you know, nice messages for the community of musically interested bagpipers or anything that's on your mind? Just, you know, I can edit this later to make it go smooth. And what's anything you want to say?
Well, maybe one thing, and this applies to hurdy-gurdy as well, is that often we get this notion that there was some magical golden age in the past.
Yeah.
When these instruments were around and great. We are in the golden age today of these instruments. They are more readily available. They are higher quality. There's more players. You have greater access. So if you want to play, you know, Northumbrian small pipes and you live in Podunk Town, Ohio, through the internet, you can gain access to resources and you can actually learn this. There is no better time in the history of this world to be playing these instruments than today. You know, don't long for the past. This is, we're in the golden age today.
That's awesome. That's definitely a strong finisher. What, I've never thought about it that way. You immediately light me up with excitement with that idea.